It's all new. The creature walks among us, more terrifying in human form, striking at the heart of the city with inhuman fury. The creature walks among us. Horror unleashed by the daring of man and a dangerous experiment of science. The creature walks among us. The grimmest cargo ever brought to civilization. Now a monster made even more frightful by human emotion.
And I clapped.
Wait, I hadn't started recording.
Oh, you don't.
No trick. No foolies.
Okay,
you
okay.
Can clap again if you want.
All right. You ready? Are you recording now?
Yeah. Yes, I am recording.
Okay, I clap.
There we go. Hey, everybody, and welcome back once again to Podcast Part 3, the Part 3 Podcast, your best and possibly only source for all things about movies that came after two other movies. And I am Sam.
And I am Will.
And I think we redeemed ourselves.
I think so.
We are back in the loving black and white embrace of the Universal Monsters, talking about the third creature from the Black Lagoon and what is technically the final Universal classic monster movie from 1956, The Creature Walks Among Us, a soapy melodrama about love, lust, murder, and revenge that happens to involve a river creature sort of standing on the periphery.
It is possibly the weirdest movie I think we've covered for this podcast.
I realized watching it that even though I am a Universal Monster fiend and I have my big box set, I don't think I'd ever seen this movie because this really, I don't know what I expected, but it wasn't quite this. This is definitely very different from the first two creature movies.
So I like this movie barely cracks 80 minutes long. I think it's like 77 minutes all told.
And a lot of it is shoe leather and footage of people swimming.
So about like for the first half, I was like, man, we're not going to have a whole lot to talk about with this one. Like, it's just sort of nothing's going on. The makeup is kind of nice, but there's a lot of swimming, a lot of shots of the boat going from one end of the frame to the other, and a lot of talking, scientists talking. And then the movie takes this turn into, I mean, you said it best, but it feels like this Tennessee Williams play in its back, like, third.
Yeah, there's obviously the first movie, and the first movie, The Creature from the Black Lagoon, and the second movie, Revenge of the Creature, are, you know, quintessential 50s monster movies that feature scientists and a hunter or a big game trapper of some sort, and there's usually some romance and a love triangle, and obviously it's because it's the Gill Man, there's a woman in a white bathing suit swimming around, but this movie is just, everyone is awful and sleazy, and there's this, the main character essentially is one of the most psychotic human beings that's ever walked the face of the earth. There's some big Frankenstein vibes,
right,
to this one.
Yeah.
But to go back, so obviously we've touched on the Universal Monsters before with Son of Frankenstein, which was back in 1942. By 1956, the entire landscape of what you'd call horror and science fiction had changed in Hollywood, and we were, the Universal Monsters, the classic ones, your mummies and Draculas and Frankensteins were, at this point, mostly hanging out with Abbott and Costello, or being remade in, like, by Hammer elsewhere.
Right.
But the final monster that was created and de facto became part of the gang is Gill Man, and he is a giant fish man who people will simply not leave alone. And he basically became part of the Universal Classic Monsters because he is one of the most instantly iconic creature designs. Like, this isn't based on a book. It's not based on a play. It's not based on any direct folklore.
Yeah.
It's just a brilliant creature design. For many years, people assumed was designed by Bud Westmore, the famous makeup artist, but was actually an animator and a special effects artist named Millicent Patrick. So, and he kind of suppressed her involvement you know, Bob Kane style.
Right.
But in recent years, we've learned about her. She created the head and face design and is kind of responsible for the whole look of the creature. Though obviously lots of people went into the creation of the costume and the stunt work and the origin also we can thank Orson Welles for.
Really? Because, I didn't know that.
Yeah, William Alland, who was the producer of, among other things, Creature from the Black Lagoon, It Came from Outer Space, Tarantula, Deadly Mantis, Mole People, and This Island Earth.
Ooh.
He was a sort of minor member of the Mercury Theater. And most people know him as an actor. He's the reporter in Citizen Kane, who's investigating everything. Yeah.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
He was... Yeah. Attending a dinner party during the filming of Citizen Kane, when a famed Mexican cinematographer Gabriel Figueroa told him about a myth about a race of half-fish, half-human creatures in the Amazon called the Yakuruna. He wrote story notes for a project called The Sea Monster, using Beauty and the Beast as an inspiration. And then many years later... some writers expanded this into the Black Lagoon. So, it was a product of Citizen Kane.
Wow. That's wild. And it's so much of, I feel like Guillermo del Toro's like core memories, I feel like, are so bound up in these movies.
I was actually thinking about this. The 1950s monster movies, the big, like, Them, or Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, or It Came from Outer Space, or Invaders from Mars. There's so many of them. I think they are, for the most part, they're very fun, pulpy, campy movies, but very stiff. Not all of them are well acted. Even if they're short, they have a lot of dead space, this movie especially. But you can definitely see how kids watched these movies in the 50s, got through the 60s, got their brains pickled by drugs, and became Dan O'Bannon in the 70s and made the likes of Alien.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think you can, and because these movies got so much play on TV, and I think people who fell in with the counterculture and sort of were like, oh yeah, what if we took those movies that I loved as a kid and like, put sort of countercultural vibes in it, which is basically also what happened with Spielberg and Lucas when they made their movies,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, because through the 50s and into the 60s especially, every local TV station had their horror host. There was like
right.
Feep and Zachary and Vampira, of course, and it was all these Universal monster movies had tons of play on TV, and these ones were no exception. But there's whole sequences in this, like the whole sequence when they're scuba diving with the, you know, and sonar is there. But that's Alien. That's Tom Skerritt
in
the vents.
Right.
It's the same. This is so stiff and kind of clunky, but it's the same energy, and I found that really interesting. This movie is such a 1950s sci-fi movie.
Oh, man, it is so 1950s.
Like, you wanted, last week, you wanted a bunch of gray, square men with a lot of Brill cream in their hair standing in rooms talking about science and the things they must do for science. Right out of the gate. They're all just climbing on that glass onion boat, one after the other.
And just hanging out and talking in sort of deep baritone voices like this, all about men and nature versus nurture.
Well, it's also got both Cal and Exeter from This Island Earth, and if you've watched the Mystery Science Theater 3000 movie as much as I have, you can't mistake Cal's voice.
No, it is so... I don't know...
The Gilman.
I don't know anything about that actor except these two movies, but like I feel like he got dealt a rotten hand. I don't know. Maybe he didn't, but
Rex Reason is the actor's name.
Of course that's his
The
name.
Elder brother of actor Rhodes Reason. He looks like he's like one of those guys who was on a million shows. Like he was on Man Without a Gun. He was on Perry Mason. He was on Wagon Train, 77
course,
Sunset Strip.
But it's like, he's like the quintessential like 50s B movie like matinee idol guy. He's got this like impossibly square jaw, and he's like, he takes this material so seriously. It's just, he's like,
it's also all these guys have the same like definitionless body. Like, yeah. Like, you know how Sean Connery would take his shirt off and he'd at least be hairy, but then Roger Moore just kind of was like one smooth tan form with like no change anywhere. That's what every 50s man's body wore, and they all wore those high crotch, high waist bathing suits.
Yeah. Yes.
But so he's hired because at the end of Revenge of the Creature, which incidentally was also a Mystery Science Theater movie, and I'm guessing that's how most people have seen it that aren't Universal horror fans.
Right.
Creature gets captured from the Black Lagoon, and he's first, let's go back. I would say The Creature from the Black Lagoon, the original, is a really fun movie. Like, of the 50s monster movies, it's probably top five. It's definitely like an S-tier monster movie. It's got a iconic score that they use here. It's Henry Mancini, actually.
Oh,
that blew Will's mind. He knocked everything off the table.
Blew my cat's mind.
Peter Gunn's Henry Mancini?
What?
Yeah, Henry Mancini of Moon River, a movie that has aged worse than The Creature That Walks Among Us. Breakfast at Tiffany's, I mean. They have a very iconic theme for the creature, and the first one's a lot of fun. The second one's kind of a watered down rehash of the first, where he gets kidnapped and it's Jaws 3. He gets taken to a Sea World, essentially, and then escapes and runs amok.
That's all I really remember is sort of people getting in and out of pools from that one. And
well, they're trying to like study him, and it mostly involves like shocking him with a cattle prod. It's it's like people seem to really want to know what his deal is, and I'm like, he's a fish man. It seems self-explanatory. He's a fish man, and he kind of can't resist blondes, you know.
Have you seen Shape of Water, Sam?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, it's so funny.
Well, Guillermo del Toro basically said, "I want to do Creature from the Black Lagoon," but he gets the girl.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's the same impetus as like Peter Jackson's King Kong, where it's like, I want to do the movie that was in my head, where King Kong's like a hero, basically, or a tragic hero anyway. And it's the same thing with Shape of Water, although Shape of Water kind of plays like a sequel almost. Yeah, well, but
it's also that Guillermo del Toro did the Hellboy movies, even though there might be, but it just goes to show how iconic the Gillman design is, that most of what we think of as Creature from the Black Lagoon stuff is inspiration, as opposed to like, if you're going to make a movie with an undersea kingdom, I don't care if it's Aquaman, Phantom Menace, the fucking Monster Squad, he just shows up, it's gonna have like a guy with gills and that like fish face, like that's just how it works.
Just has to.
But so that brings us to The Creature Walks Among Us, which starts with Dr. Barton, aka Ugly James Garner, hires some other scientists like him. He's a surgeon, and he's very excited about the prospect of doing surgery on a boat. He's hired them to head out to the Everglades to find the Gillman. Now, maybe I had looked at my phone for a moment, but correct me if I'm wrong, Will. He wants to study the Gillman to see if he can help learn about how to make the human race evolve to the point where we can go to space.
Yeah, that's the impression. Yeah,
all right,
that's what I got.
Okay, so this is NASA when they were just handing out government contracts to anyone that came along.
Hey, I hear about this Gillman in the Florida Everglades. Can I have a grant? Sure, go study it. Maybe we can use it. Application in space.
To quote Mystery Science Theater, the movie. This is back when science didn't have to have any specific purpose.
It is baffling, and for some reason, he brings along his wife.
Well, his wife, whom he married when she was 17 years old, and she's 27 now, and she's younger, and she's clearly not happy, and he's a fucking psychopath, and the Marlon Brando-looking, like, hunter guy cannot stop hitting on her.
And she keeps telling him no. It's really...
The
gender politics of this movie are so wild.
It's so funny because ultimately the protagonist is neither her husband or the other love interest. He's the third guy. He's Rex Reason, who is basically it's a moment where he tells her, like, I think your husband needs psychiatric help. Like, where he's just like, I just had a conversation with him down in the barn while we were watching the Gillman putter around with the sheep, and he's not okay.
It really is. It's men would rather study strange river creatures than go to therapy.
It's hilarious. And so they capture him in a Abbott and Costello caliber series of chuckle fuck mishaps where they all get in the boat and Gillman breaks their one spotlight. So they break out their backup lights, which appear to be just Molotov cocktails.
They set him on fire and then shoot him with an arrow. And
fuck up his gills, bring him on the boat. Give him a tracheotomy, open up his, like, half-evolved lungs, and he starts transforming into what I can only assume is we don't have the budget for the Gillman suit anymore. We're going to put him in a pantsuit. A different
face. And they the one, like, hunter guy, they make him, like, stitch up all the clothing, and he does a pretty good job.
He whips together, like, a real, like, you know, Frankenstein onesie pretty quick.
Yeah.
His first 60 minutes are watching these assholes fuck up Gilman's life completely. So he's stuck on land now. He can't go to the ocean. All he wants to do is just all he does for the rest of the movie is stare wistfully at the sea. For the last 25 minutes of the movie, while Dr. Barton, the older husband, goes very quickly insane with jealousy as his wife is macked on by other people.
Right, but she doesn't reciprocate, which is the really important thing.
She doesn't like him, but she's not trying to cheat on him.
No, and the one guy is, like, so aggressive with her that it's just, like, it is very, very icky.
Gilman's not even in. Usually that role belongs to Gilman.
To Gilman.
He can't carry her off.
And Gilman actually, like, helps her, because on the boat, that guy is trying to, like, actually assault her, and Gilman comes in and kicks the tar out of him. It's
just... And then at the end, Dr. Barton murders him in a rage and then tries to frame Gilman. And it's like for the last 90 seconds of the movie, it's Gilman is just like, fuck this, and busts out, kills Dr. Barton. And the last we see of him is him walking towards the water, even though he's going to drown. It's this sad, ambiguous ending. There's a little pontificating in there, too. Like,
right,
how far have we risen from the jungle yet to reach the stars or whatever?
Some very semi-poetic horse shit. But it's just amazing to me. I honestly, Sam, like I said, I thought I was kind of bored for about the first, you know, 45 minutes.
Well, it's like, you know what's happening. It's like they do this in every one of these movies.
Yeah, it's King Kong. It's following sort of the tropes, and I was like, geez, is there gonna be anything to talk about? And then it just takes this insane turn where I was like, holy shit, this movie's incredible.
This felt like they took a half finished Gilman script, and then we're like, well, we had like a treatment for a Frankenstein movie set in the Bay Area, and
yeah, and it's like, you know, I almost wanted this whole movie to sort of follow on the promise of the premise of sort of bringing Gilman into the streets of modern day San Francisco, of him like wandering around and fucking shit up. I don't know. Like, I wanted more of that.
That's Revenge of the Creature. That's him bumming around like Orlando fucking things. No, like,
but that in that one he looks more like Gilman.
Yeah, he stays Gilman in that one. This is the one where it's like, oh, he's gonna die at the end because these jackoffs couldn't leave him alone.
It's amazing, and again, like this marital psychodrama that just like takes shape in the back in the last little bit is just so wild.
It has nothing to do with Gilman. Like, there's this whole scene in the barn where he's talking to Rex Reason, and they're having this whole like, conversation, metaphorical about like nature versus nurture and like killer instinct and, you know, kindness versus cruelty, and you know, they're talking about Gilman, but they're clearly talking about this doctor and what a fucking nut he is.
It's just, I don't know. It's just one of those things, and like no one talks about this movie ever. So no. It's like there was no reason why I would ever know about
this. Yeah, I mean, this one's kind of just dismissed out of hand, like because the none of the creature movies have like the same atmosphere as the 30s and 40s stuff. It's like they're not the same kind of movie as The Mummy or Frankenstein or The Wolfman or any of those. They're just part of the same box set.
Right.
But they're very much like those movies inform, like there's a split, like the movies of the 30s and 40s informed horror of the 60s, 70s and 80s. And I would say the 50s movies informed science fiction and some horror of the 70s and 80s.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're right. 'Cause like, you know, the like surgery scene feels very much like the like John Carpenter's The Thing, or even, you know, Alien when they're taking apart the facehugger, or any Guillermo del Toro monster movie where there's some scene where they're cutting the thing open and looking inside.
Yeah, it was basically, you know, once you could get past the like ratings board, it's like right, these sensors, movies are so tame in comparison, but they just, it's like, what even. Like, it's just, they're so different than what we have now. Like, you'd obviously have, like, these characters would be in a horror movie now. They'd be in there in an A24 movie, and the movie would be really like, yeah, it's, Midsommar is about a cult, but really it's about getting out of a toxic relationship, you know? It's like, it's...
No, I mean, you could take basically the last little bit of this movie, expand it into a full movie, and it would be a prestige horror movie now.
I want your revolutionary road, but it's Dr. Frankenstein, you know?
Exactly, yeah. But you can't do it now because Shape of Water kind of did a lot of it.
That's
so,
the thing, is that, like, it's maybe, is it funnier that the Gill Man is completely uninvolved in any of the drama? Because, like, Shape of Water, they horny for each other, like...
That's
true. She wants Fishman and he wants her, you know. It's
that's a good point. And in this it's like the Gillman's incidental to this one doctor just going off the rails and losing
his
mind.
Trying to prove that, like, making him like he's evolving him and he's not gonna be a murderer. But it's like he's not a murderer.
He's not really a murderer anyway.
He's an animal. You took him out of his environment.
Yeah, and it's like, and then you show him a modicum of kindness, so he's kind of like, all right, I guess you guys seem okay. And then, like, a bobcat tries to eat him and eat his sheep friends. And he's
like, that's what I want. I want Free Willy, but it's just a 6'2" fishman in a pantsuit that jumps over the...
Yeah!
It's a strange movie, but it was a lot of fun. It was just such a, like, I didn't expect this to be so weird.
I think that's what was made it so refreshing, because, again, it starts out, you're like, all right, I know everything about this movie. I know how it's going to end. I know exactly all the beats. I know what's going to happen. You really don't.
I think that's, you're watching the evolution of horror and science fiction, like, build to their peak in the late 70s and the 80s onward. The 30s gave you the atmosphere, and the 40s and 50s gave you, we can have character arcs, and then the 60s were like, okay, we can have blood and titties now. Like, it's, you know, all of that stuff combining till you get to Alien or Halloween or Texas Chainsaw Massacre or The Fly or things like that.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, it is, and it's always fun, at least for me, because I'm a dork, and I think for you too, is to look back at, well,
yeah, I'm a dork.
I didn't want to speak for you, but it's to look back, you know, sort of on movies of the past and sort of see where the building blocks sort of came from.
Well, it's tough for us. There's not a lot of these got threequels.
That's true. Now we can't.
Couple other Universal monsters. I think Invisible Agent is the third Invisible Man.
Oh man, that probably has the same problem, right? It's probably like the first like hour 45 minutes is boring and the last 20 minutes is like exciting secret agent invisible stuff.
I think he actually gets parachuted into Europe pretty quickly. It's kind of like Robert Stack's arc in To Be or Not to Be.
Oh, okay.
Only he's invisible, and instead of Sigrumon, it's Peter Lorre playing a Japanese guy.
Oh, okay. So. All right. Well, you know.
it's not bad. The Invisible Man movies all have the fun special effects in right. some form or another. The second one had Vincent Price as well as the Invisible Man.
Well, and it, you know, contrasting it with the Frankenstein, the Son of Frankenstein we watched, was that last year or was that 2 years ago? Anyway, whatever.
2 years ago. 2 years ago.
It was 2 years ago?
It was 2 years ago.
Oh, my God.
Last year was, like, we did Psycho 3.
I think. Right. We did Psycho 3 and Texas Chainsaw 3. And
Hellraiser 3.
Hellraiser 3, right.
Blade Trinity.
Blade Trinity. Man, I always pick one stinker.
You like your 90s, 2000s garbage. It's fine. I forgive you.
I don't remember. And so that one had like that really cool production design, and this one has like some really cool makeup effects too.
Yeah, it's the thing is the production design is pretty generic to 50s sci-fi in this. I think that's not really what you're interested in at that point in genre filmmaking are the effects and the makeup and how they do it. Like them has the giant prosthetic ants.
Yeah.
Beast of 20,000 Fathoms is Ray Harryhausen.
Yeah.
You know, it goes on like that. It's not a lot of like really good ones in there, but the ones that are the best ones do a good job building the suspense in that first act. Them does a really good job.
Yeah, Them really plays up that mystery, which is sort of unfortunate that it's called Them and the poster has, you know, ants all over it, but it
you gotta
know.
Get butts and seats, man.
I know.
That's how you get the kids to the theater.
I know. But again, because if you didn't know that movie was about giant ants, you would be really like, whoa, what is happening? What is this movie all about?
What if you get out there and you think it's like Hills Have Eyes, Hill Cannibals, and then you're like, shit, this is way worse.
It's fucking giant ants. Oh my God. Make that into an A24 movie, for fuck's sake. Remake Them.
I don't even know how they'd start. I don't know how they're going to do a new Creature movie. How do you do it after Shape of Water?
Yeah, I don't think you do it. I think you
can. They're doing it.
Are they? I mean, they know they've been talking about it for a long time.
They just announced, I think, like in August, that James Wan's on board.
Oh, well.
Because he's done Fishman movies before.
He can do water. We know that. If it's him, I think it's going to be a little more tongue-in-cheek. I think it'll probably feel a little more like Jackson's King Kong. That would be my thought.
A little more
into the adventure or more into the horror, one or the other. I don't know. Sam, have you seen the trailer for Werewolves? Did you see?
Is that the one with Frank Grillo?
Yes.
I have not yet, but I heard it's fun.
I saw the trailer for it before The Apprentice, and I nearly leapt out of my seat and applauded. The opening line is, last year, the full moon turned everyone into werewolves. And I was like, oh, fuck, I'm so on board. So it's basically The Purge, but werewolves. Like
I would
that's
love
a premise.
It if I look it up and no movie like this exists and you just had a stroke.
I just like went into a catatonic state before The Apprentice and just...
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Werewolf movies are... You can play around with them a lot. There's only so much you can do with a fish man because he's a lot more like a vampire, but in a much narrower field, you know, because he's got the erotic pull.
Right.
There's something very sexual about the Gill Man and that face of his.
It's the, you know, the weird eyes.
The drawn down, like, beaker and mouth.
Yeah, the frowny face. I don't know what you do with a Gill Man.
Well, he's literally got a swimmer's body.
That's
so,
true.
You know, I
that's
guess there's
true.
Something to that.
Yeah.
But, no, I think, yeah, I guess it's just, do you make him a villain? Do you make him a misunderstood hero, a tragic monster,
right.
like a Frankenstein or a King Kong or Gill Man in this movie? I guess it's just where you go. He's the least imitated, least revisited of the Universal monsters. So, you know, I'm curious to see where they go. But anytime he does show up, it's always fun. Like, there's no lead up to his appearance in Monster Squad.
Right, he just shows up, yeah.
And you're like, oh, okay, Gill Man here.
Gill Man's
well.
Hanging out, yeah. And again, like you said, it's just instantly iconic. That the design and like the poster for that first movie is so like just it's so iconic. It's one of those things that's like you just nail it right out of the gate. How do you?
Yeah.
You don't really change it.
Apart from like changing it, making the special effects more advanced, but right. It's not like the Gill Man can't do all that much. He's right. Pretty mobile.
He's
like,
just a dude. Yeah.
They nailed the underwater swimming. That stuff's always incredible in all three of these movies. It's all three are Riku Browning, who passed away not that long ago, and is... He could apparently hold his breath while swimming in that suit for like 2 minutes at a time, which is nuts.
That's insane.
Yeah. Can you imagine being put in the water in that outfit?
It would be, and I'm sure it like weighs a ton and just, oh my God. The scene.
Just sink to the bottom.
The scene.
I could do the scene where he's dead at the
end.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. The scene where Cal has to jump in and like feed him his oxygen tube. I thought that was pretty cool. That was a great moment.
It's so sad. He's just he fucked up his life. He had a good thing going. It's like Slimer in the new Ghostbusters, where he's like, we first met Slimer. He was living large at the Sedgwick Hotel, living his best life, and now he lives in an abandoned attic full of trash, you know? So does no one think of the monster, you know?
Man is the real monster, Sam.
It's true. It's like Kong, you could argue, he's the last of his kind. He's stuck on an island with tons of things trying to kill him. Gilman's, he's the alpha man in the Amazon.
That's true. Yeah, no one really is trying to get him, except these chuckle fucks, but, you know.
Oh, my God. It's just, it's so... It's so quintessential that you have to laugh, because it's like this was every movie like this from the 30s into this era was just tampering in God's domain, as Bride of the Monster would put it.
Yeah.
And it's the only variation is how self-aware are the characters of how much tampering they're doing in God's domain.
Right. And what the creature is they're trying to get. It's like
King Kong is not, the original is not remotely self-aware. Like, they're just like, stupid, dumb gorilla.
Yeah, pretty much.
Let's shoot everything we see on Skull Island. But then, like, you get to, not that they're on the same par, but like I was gonna go to Bride of the Monster as my next example, but I was like, well, I could just say Frankenstein. Like Frankenstein onward has more self-awareness. This movie, I think, is actually more self-aware than the second movie in terms of just, it's how much are you willing to dedicate to the pontificating. It's right, very right. clunky, but that is kind of the variation, is how thoughtful do they claim they want to be.
Right, and this one tries. There's a lot of speechifying about nature versus nurture. I don't quite... It's like the speechifying is almost too like obtuse at times, where I'm like, I'm not sure what point you're trying to make here.
That scene in the barn does feel like it would end with like, are we talking about the same thing?
Exactly.
They all feel like speeches that another Twilight Zone writer would write in the episode, and then Rod Serling would be like, "Jump, God, all right, we can get this down to two sentences and some visuals, and the rest of it I will say at the end while smoking a cigarette."
Exactly.
Like, this movie would end with like, "Submitted for your approval, a man who, can, a man out of, a man who yearns for what belongs to him." You know.
Yeah. Exactly. poor Gill Man.
Poor Gill Man. Poor guy. You feel bad for him.
You really do.
And the movie wants you to feel bad for him, too.
Yeah, no, it does.
That's the thing I actually appreciate, is that he's like, the movie is like, yeah, they really fucked up your life, guy.
At no point are we ever to be, are we on the scientist's side at what they're trying to do? And that that is something to the movie's credit. It's not like something where our modern sensibilities are imposed on it. This is clearly like from the movie's perspective.
And the movie's main plot is a woman stuck in a love triangle with two of the most unlikable people you've ever met.
Yeah, it's more like, I guess it is a love triangle, but it's like there are...
Well, it's a love triangle where she's not interested in either, but they hate each other, and they won't leave her alone.
Yeah. It's kind of like a love square, right? Because there's that one guy, the hunter guy.
I don't think he's into her. He's married to his work.
Well, I mean, the guy who keeps accosting her. Because there's
That's who I'm talking about.
Oh, okay, but then there's Cal, and then there's
Cal's
also...
not into her. Cal's just a friend.
Okay, yeah. Okay, all right.
Cal's like Horatio in Hamlet. He's just like there to bear witness to the tragedy.
Okay, see, I figured he was into her, but maybe that's
He has like the one scene where he's like, "I didn't know you played guitar." And, I don't anymore because my life sucks. But, yeah, and then he's like, "Yeah, I noticed your husband is an insane person."
He is the only one who like takes an actual interest in her as like a human being.
Well, because there's two characters too many compared to the prior two movies. In the first two movies, the love triangle is main guy, main girl, and Gilman.
Right.
And it's Gilman and the main guy have to wrestle around because Gilman ran off with his girl. Right. In this one, there's a young jerk, old jerk, woman, third guy, and Gilman. And the two other scientists who are just, like, amazingly don't get killed in this movie.
Right, and there's a chef, too, who's there, too.
Is there any... Does anyone get killed in this movie besides...
No one dies, besides
the two guys at the end?
I think maybe Gilman knocks out or throws another guy against a wall when he makes his escape at the end.
But oh, maybe.
Like a guard or something.
Oh, yeah, that one guy takes a hit through the door. Yeah. Real, like Gene Kelly in Singing in the Rain stunt.
Man, Gilman just breaks through those doors. That guy
is so strong.
Boom!
It's like, is he the strongest universal monster? I think it's him or the monster. It's him or the monster, yeah. Bela Lugosi might be really strong, but he's not going to be bothered.
No, I mean, Dracula is very strong, but he just, you know, he's got more of a...
I don't need strength, I have vibes.
Exactly. Double jointed and Hungarian.
Invisible Man would be like, would think he's super strong, and you just hear him like slamming himself against that like fence over and over.
I'm gonna get it. I promise. Next try. Okay, next try.
Just a naked man throwing himself against an electric fence over and over. See, this is what I want from my League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, is just shenanigans like this.
I would rather that than, I think, either the movie version or the comic book version, you know?
The comic book's really good, but it's also, like, I don't know. It's not terribly satisfying.
No, well, it also has that, like, Alan Moore, like, I have to deconstruct everything and put, like, weird pornographic sex in everything, and it's a little weird.
And then by the end of it, it's just like, okay, Alan, you clearly have an axe to grind against Harry Potter as a concept. We get it. Okay.
Yeah, it gets a little... like a lot of Alan Moore... modern Alan Moore stuff, it sort of goes off the rails. I think he's a little off the rails, though, so,
oh,
you know.
Alan Moore? No. Watchmen's, I mean, Alan Moore?
I mean, probably all justified his hate towards DC Comics and Marvel Comics.
Oh, but... I'm not saying they didn't, like, screw him, like, over and over on anything he ever got involved with them, but still, I don't know if it's entirely on him, but it's like, good Lord, I don't ever need to hear about the Killing Joke ever again in my life.
No.
Ever again.
And to be fair, he's even owned up to that one, being like, yeah, that wasn't very good, so... No.
What pisses me off is that it's become so famous is that I used to have it in a volume of other DC stuff, and now you have to buy it separately.
Yeah. In that,
so you used to get it with the, like, For the Man Who Has Everything and all those other really good short ones.
And whatever the...
Whatever Happened to the Man
of
Tomorrow.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. But, and the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen movie is just... so silly. It's the silliest movie.
That's one of those.
Remember we talked about how some movies are sloppy babies? That movie is a sloppy baby.
Oh man, that movie clearly had like so many competing elements and like so many studio notes. I mean,
it drove multiple people out of the business forever. Stephen Norrington never made another movie. Sean Connery retired.
Yeah. Which is a shame. I think Stephen Norrington should be making movies. He should be doing stuff.
He'd at least be directing like Game of Thrones. Or
yeah,
something.
Exactly.
You know, he'd at least have like a Neil Marshall type career.
Yeah.
But man, the irony is it's the only movie to really nail the literary Captain Nemo correctly.
I know.
It's this terrible movie, and then in the middle of it is Nasiruddin Shah just being on point.
Yeah, it is. It's very, it's like, oh, come on, they couldn't, oh, man.
This Hollywood is strange, man. You and I have been around here long enough to know this is a weird place where people make weird choices.
Yep, yep. And no more weird than this movie that we just discussed.
And this probably just, and I'm guessing this movie was made, like, everyone was making it with their eyes closed. This was probably, like, clockwork, too.
Yeah,
this
was not,
like, this was just like, yeah, sure, yeah, whatever, way. Shoot, it's, Ed Wood, shoot whatever you want as long as it's seven reels long.
Yeah, and then you can get it done in, like, I don't know, a month? Sure, have fun.
Yeah, so we have a boat, we got the suit, and we have clearance to work in this state park in Florida.
Go, do.
Yeah, go, be gone, be gone. So I walk aimlessly into the ocean, never to return.
Well done.
Thank you. Yes. But until next time, Will, delightful. This was fun.
This was fun.
I love my monster movies.
I know.
I love them. I love my Universal monster movies. They're so silly, and they're so iconic.
And this one was fun to talk about, because it just, it threw me for such a loop. So.
I had no idea that we were going to get this wonderful, like, parlor melodrama for the last 25 minutes that had a fish man watching through the window.
And then he smashes some stuff. But
well, when he looks like, when he's going to get framed for murder, he has to defend himself. He sees the guy dragging the body into his pen. He's like, what? No, fuck that.
He's like, no, you can't do that. That's not cool.
You fucking dick. Do you know who I am? I'm Gilman. Will, always a delight.
Always a delight, and don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe.
What he said. We will see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.